Hello, this is Moses Ross, and you are listening to PDX Progressive Talk Radio on KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. And if you live here in Portland, you may be aware from our last election that we are changing, making some fundamental changes in the Portland city government. Voters approved at the last election cycle a ballot measure that would change the Portland Charter, which is our governing document, to include changes such as ranked choice voting, geographic districts, a bigger city council, and new leadership roles. And these changes basically can be summarized in three connected changes. It's allowing voters to be able to rank candidates in order of their preference. And it does this by using ranked choice voting. Secondly, it establishes four geographic districts within Portland, with three city council members elected to represent each district. And it expands our current city council to a total of 12 members, up from our current four-member city council, five, including the mayor. Finally, it establishes a city council that focuses on setting policy and engaging with the community. And it's transitioning day-to-day oversight of bureaus to a mayor elected citywide and a professional city administrator. So these are some real fundamental changes. And Portland for years has taken a lot of pride in its unique form of city government. But obviously, people have had enough, and voters have had enough, and we're making that change. Now, part of those three, the second aspect of the change was the creation of these geographic districts. Right now, city council's members are elected citywide, not representing a particular area or not. That has changed with the new system. And a commission was established called the Independent District Commission to help establish these new geographic boundaries for the city of Portland. To that end, I have with me Kari Chisholm. Kari is a member of the Independent District Commission, and we're going to be discussing some of the thought and the process involved with establishing these geographic districts and where they stand now in their work as far as implementing it for next year. So, Kari Chisholm, hello. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Moses. It's always a pleasure to talk to the KBOO audience.
Right on. Well, thank you. And, you know, one thing I love about the KBOO audience is that they're engaged and they're knowledgeable. And so I try to respect that by giving them engaged and knowledgeable guests. And so that's why I've asked you to kind of share with us what is your impressions of how the commission is doing and the type of work that you're doing on that commission, sir.
Yeah, let me start by saying that the 13-member commission has been one of the more extraordinary bodies I've ever been part of. It's an extraordinarily diverse group of folks in every possible way. They are from every corner of our great city. They represent a number of communities within our city, racial, ethnic, and language communities, but also communities of different aspects of folks who are engaged, business community, and so forth. Neighborhood association folks, there are folks who come to it with expertise in city planning. I'm a political consultant, so I come to it with an expertise in politics. Our campaigns are work and run. There are folks who've run nonprofits. There are folks who have been engaged in city politics for decades in some cases. So it's a really extraordinary group of people. And we've worked really well together, even when we disagreed. And we did have some very strong disagreements along the way. But we found a way to come together in a consensus form to work together, put together maps. We have Any member of the public could submit maps. We got well over 200 submissions from the public. We looked at all of them. Several of us, me included, kind of took it upon ourselves to do our best to develop maps that both complied with the law, complied with our sort of Portland values about inclusivity and representation, to try and deal with some historic challenges in representation in the city of Portland, and then reach out to lots and lots of people. And all three of the current maps, which we might think of as semi-finalists, are the result of enormous amounts of collaboration between the members of the commission, as well as feedback from the public. And of course, not everybody gets what they want. No single map will ever be perfect, but the goal is to produce in the end, by September 1st, a map that makes sense to the people of Portland and is a good starting place for the decades to come of the new Portland district-based city council.
Well, you know, one of the biggest issues with the old system of government was many people in the East County areas felt underrepresented on the city council. And I'm sure that that could be extrapolated to other communities within Portland as well. How did you take that into account, those concerns?
Yeah, so, you know, I live on the west side, but it is super apparent to me, as a political professional, that the communities east of 205, you might also say east of 82nd, you might also say the communities that are largely out, the four school districts that are not the Portland Public School District, that's all overlap. Those three ways to describe them are all overlaps. Those folks have often not gotten representation directly at city council. Randy Leonard in 2002 was the first person ever elected to Portland City Council from east of 82nd Avenue. And depending on how you keep score, we've had a total of two or three members of the council. People move from east of 82nd. And so it was tremendously important to me, and it became clear that it was a unanimously held consensus in the commission that those communities east of 82nd or 205 ought to be in a single district. And just to put a point on something, what we're going to have is a council with 12 members, but we're only drawing four districts. So each of the four districts will elect three members of the commission in this ranked choice voting thing. We're not having anything to do with the ranked choice voting part, but to recognize that east of 82nd, we will, in the very first election in 2024, elect as many or more members of the city council from east of 82nd than in the entire history of Portland combined. And that to me is tremendously powerful and tremendously important. You know, these are communities that have felt under-resourced, underrepresented, ignored. And I know that members of the council who've been there in the past have tried to do their best. And where you live isn't necessarily who you fight for, but it is important for every Portlander to feel like there's someone at city council that represents them. And so that east of 82nd or east of 205 component was really sort of important to, as it turns out, all 13 of us.
Well, you know, and another, you know, taking that one, trying to, as I understand correctly, you're trying to keep common neighborhood groups. There were factors in creating these districts that natural, like for instance, when you in your West Side districts, I noticed that you had parts of the East Side included in those West Sides. What was the logic behind that?
Well, let me start talking about the sort of the areas that are different among these three maps. And by the way, the maps are known by names now. We got confused on the numbers and letters. So the maps are known as Alder, Cedar, and Maple. And, you know, all three of those finalist maps, again, everything east of 205, excuse me, is in a single district, the Eastern District. All four of the non-PPS school districts, Park Rose, David Douglas, Reynolds, and Centennial, are in that Eastern District. Everything in the northern part of Portland, so if you will, sort of north and northeast Portland, with the exception of the Park Rose School District, is in a single district. The historic Albina community in north-northeast Portland, the historically black part of Portland, back from when there was redlining, is all kept together in a single district, that northern district. And yes, all communities west of the Willamette River are in a single western district. So those elements were the result of a strong consensus, particularly the east district and the west district components. It didn't make sense to anybody to split the west into the western part of Portland into two districts. But once you sort of agreed to those basic principles, you start to look at, you know, you got to make the districts roughly equal in population. And the west side of Portland, if you can draw four districts, they're all going to be 25%, give or take. And the west side of Portland, west of the Willamette River, is 21-22% of the population of the city. So it had to go across the river somewhere. And another criteria that's required legally is that the districts have to be connected with transportation links. What that means is you should be able to drive to every part of a district without leaving the district. So you're talking about roads and bridges in particular here. So that meant that the West Side District had to cross in one of really three places, or at least one of three places. It could either cross at St. John's Bridge, and the West District could include parts of St. John's, sort of heading toward, you know, the University of Portland. Or it could cross in the south over the Selwood Bridge and pick up that sort of Selwood, Westmoreland, Eastmoreland, you know, Reed College area. Or it could cross essentially a downtown and come across in the central city, if you will. And what you see in the three finalist maps is we decided as a group, as a consensus, though not unanimously, that St. John's did not make any sense. We heard lots of feedback from folks in St. John's and said, we don't want to be with the west side. And to my mind, that makes sense. There's not a lot of population at the north end of the west side. If you live in St. John's, you're going to got to drive 20 minutes to get to downtown. So it made sense to me that it would either be the Selwood zone or the central city zone. And so in the three maps, what you have is one map is strongly sort of coming across from the west into the Selwood zone. You get another, that's Alder. And then there's the Maple map, which comes across at the central city. We can talk more about that since I was the sort of key driver of that map. And then you got Cedar, which sort of does a little of both, if you will, and is designed really around transportation corridors and that sort of thing. But you had to come across somewhere. And I think it's a perfectly reasonable discussion to talk about what makes sense. Who are the people that most fit the sort of west side community, if you will, that happen to live on the east side? And are there other things we're trying to accomplish in building these maps in terms of representation and equity?
Well, let's talk about that for a second. You know, what type of other representation did you have to take into account to come up with those two options for the west side? You know, central versus Selwood, for instance.
Yeah, so let me talk about the Maple map, and that's, again, the central city one. So on that map, which you guys, everything west of the river is in a single district. And then it comes across, and basically everything between I-84 and Powell Boulevard up to 12th is in the district, plus the rest of the Buckman and Kearns neighborhoods. So basically what you're talking about is the neighborhoods along Sandy Boulevard going up to 33rd, but not into Laurelhurst. It breaks at Laurelhurst. And again, I was the primary driver of that map, and though it represents a lot of consensus work among the commission and represents a lot of external feedback. And my first draft was not the same as my second, third, fourth, or 10th, or 15th draft. What we've got now is probably out into the 20th version of it. Here's why it makes sense to me, the Maple map. In 1985, the city of Portland engaged in something called the Central City Plan. And it was a recognition from the sort of planning bureau that downtown is different. Downtown needs different zoning rules. They've got big buildings, and dense urban environment. You know, you're going to have parking meters. You're going to have tall apartment buildings. It's got to be able to handle transit when people coming in and out, using downtown as a workplace, but not their bedroom. And so downtowns can be really different. And then we built the Lloyd District area and recognized that was going to be sort of another kind of downtown. And then we built South Waterfront to create sort of both office and workplace sort of area. And again, tall buildings, dense, transit oriented. And so those zones were really designed to be sort of an extended downtown. And then, of course, starting to see that on the Inner East Side as well. Things that are already happening with those big warehouses on the Inner East Side that have become loft apartments. OMSI is in the midst of building, of conceptualizing a dense neighborhood around OMSI, sort of under the Markham Bridge there. And then, so to me, it was important that if we're going to build a city council map, that we do so with that central city plan in mind. It was conceived in 1985, and then they revised it starting in 2015. They finished it just as the pandemic was starting in 2020, with the recognition that, you know, we got to adjust sort of the boundaries of this thing, and we have to adjust sort of against some of the zoning stuff. Well, of course, the pandemic happened, and downtown emptied out of office workers. And now I think we all recognize that it's really important for the city of Portland, for the region, for the entire state, really, that downtown come back. And we're going to have lots of conversations about work from home and employers and should we turn office buildings into apartment buildings and all that. Whatever the solutions are, we know that that's a problem. And the city is going to spend at least the next decade, if not more, trying to figure out how to solve that. And to my mind, and the mind of a lot of folks in the districting commission, it makes sense to have that area inside a single city council district. So you have three people in the council who really feel like they own that problem. Mm. Now, that central city zone does include Lloyd District and Lower Albina. In my first drafts, my first 10 drafts, those were included in the West Side District as well. But then it became clear, particularly after Phil Knight made his $400 million donation to begin to revitalize Lower Albina, that Lower Albina and Lloyd District zone needed to be held together with the rest of the historically Black Albina district, that the redevelopment and rejuvenation of that area, again, needs to be within a single district so that you have three councilors who really sort of feel like they own that challenge. So then, having taken Lloyd District and Lower Albina out of the West Side District, it needs to grow some more somewhere else. And several of us sort of studied that problem and realized, you know, if you look at a map of Portland and you highlight all the little tiny census blocks where 70% or more of the residents live in apartment buildings, what you'll find is an extraordinary density of that downtown, of course, Portland State University, South Waterfront, Pearl District, Old Town, but also along Sandy Boulevard in the Buckman and Kearns neighborhoods. There's a tremendous number of big, dense apartment buildings along in the Buckman and Kearns area along Sandy Boulevard. And there's some other spots, some spots along 82nd. There's some spots up along I-84. No surprise, there are apartment buildings near freeways. That's an equity issue. But if you're going to collect a bunch of them into a single district, to my mind, it made sense. Take those renter-heavy, apartment-dense communities of Buckman and Kearns, pair them with the renter-heavy, apartment-dense communities of Old Town, Pearl District, University, Downtown, South Waterfront, and again, put them all together and really create, in my mind, a representation for renters in Portland. And speaking as a political professional, create political power for renters. We tend to think of downtown as a place with a lot of money, but that's because there are businesses there with a lot of money. The residents in downtown are actually disproportionately low income. And so it's important to me to take those low income renters downtown, the low to middle income renters on the Inner East Side along Sandy Boulevard, and put them together in a single district so that they have the power to elect a, we'll call it a renter's rights champion. Our goal in this mapping process is not to try and predict or create election outcomes is to focus on representation. And of course, the actual election outcomes will be determined by who runs and how well they run and how good the job is they do, how much money they raise and all the rest of it. But to me, it's important that we don't take those renter-centric neighborhoods and shatter them into two or three city council districts, undermining their ability to organize and fight for representation. Well, that, to me, is the Maple Map.
That's the Maple Map. Yeah, it's, you know, what's interesting to me is just with my experience in Southwest, and I don't mean to sound like I'm not prejudicial, but creating a, you know, a fantasy of it all, but it's like, it seems to me that there's a lot of single family homes out here in Southwest. There's a lot of, not a lot of renters, but that's not necessarily true. You know, in at least along the Barber Boulevard corridors, along the main corridors within the Southwest, there are these real pockets of high density. And it is intriguing to me how you are combining these interests through the empowerment of the renters, you know, so the interest of a renter in Southwest off of Beaverton Hillsdale Highway may be a little bit different than, but have a lot of common factors with someone that's renting in high density over on Buckman.
Yeah, you know, the West Side has often been used as a synonym for, you know, rich white families. And there are definitely pockets of that throughout the West Hills in particular. I'm reminded of the Everclear song, which he sings, you know, "I will buy you a big house way up in the West Hills." Art Alexakis, Portland resident. But it is definitely true that Southwest also has, as the entire city does, its low-income communities. There are elementary schools in Southwest that are more than 50% free and reduced lunch. So we shouldn't think of the West Side as being dominated by wealthy individuals. And to my mind, we should be doing what we can to ensure that lower income folks, particularly renters, have the representation they need so that they can get the, you know, equitable outcomes that they deserve. Right. So I do want to talk about the Alder map, which again, I prefer the Maple map, but we are open to a position of listening to the public. We'll talk about hearings in a minute, but I do want to be fair to the folks who worked very hard to build the Alder map. And the Alder map is the one that largely goes across at Selwood. And, you know, their view, and I should say, I'll describe the map. It comes across basically everything south of Holgate and west of Cesar Chavez or 39th is in the western map. There's a little bit of stuff along sort of Johnson Creek area along the Clackamas County border there that goes a little bit past Cesar Chavez. But certainly everything west of Cesar Chavez and south of Holgate is then over in the West Side map. So that's basically, you know, Selwood, Westmoreland, Eastmoreland, up into Reed College kind of area. And there, the idea is that socioeconomically speaking, the communities there in that sort of southwest corner of southeast Portland look an awful lot like the West Side. In short, Selwood is like Multnomah Village. You know, Eastmoreland is sort of like parts of Southwest. And that's a perfectly reasonable position. I will say that map also, in particular, does its level best to really respect neighborhood association boundaries. Most of the map, all the maps really at this point, largely do sort of focus on neighborhood association boundaries. There's some elements here where what we're doing on the West Side there in order to balance the map, there's some adjustments that occur up in the Northeast Portland area, sort of along Sandy Boulevard and 47th Fremont, that whole area. And we can talk more about that. But in particular, the Alder map, as they focus up there, again, are drawn along neighborhood association boundaries in a way that particularly the Cedar map does not sort of care about neighborhood association boundaries.
Interesting. So, but, you know, as someone that's really involved with the neighborhood associations, I understand that there's a potential, there's concerns from the neighborhood associations that they're not going to have the full representation that they have had in the past because of the redistricting.
Yeah, and that's been a conversation we've had quite a bit on the commission, and a question that I have sort of struggled with. You know, the argument in favor of respecting neighborhood association boundaries is that we have these organizations in the city who already do some of the work of lifting up neighborhood voices, organizing them together, having regular meetings. And wouldn't it be great if we had city council members who knew which neighborhoods they represented and represented the minimum number of neighborhood associations so they could spend the maximum amount of time meeting with those neighborhood associations. Obviously, if you have, you know, a dozen or two dozen neighborhoods that are split between city council districts, it's potential they could be ignored by those city council members, or those city council members would feel obligated to attend those meetings. Now they got to go to, you know, 35 meetings instead of two dozen or whatever it is, and so forth. Not giving as much time. The counter argument, the sort of anti-neighborhood association argument, if you will, really was that the neighborhood associations don't do a good job of lifting up voices and organizing neighborhood residents, because the people who primarily show up at neighborhood associations tend to be older, whiter, wealthier, and more homeowners, disproportionately homeowners. And so if you empower the neighborhoods, you are disempowering low-income folks, people of color, renters, and so forth. You know, I've gone back and forth both ways. On the one hand, it's definitely true in terms of the demographics of who shows up in neighborhood associations. On the other hand, maybe that's the thing we ought to work on fixing rather than trying to sort of sort through the city council map that way. I will say that the map I developed, Maple, early on, I was not paying attention to neighborhood associations, but then as we got to fine-tuning, it often just made sense. Many of the neighborhood association boundaries are where they are because of the communities of interest that underlie them. Many are not. Some of them reflect decades ago, you know, segregations that were happening. And so we have to be careful to not sort of continue to extend, shall we say, bad behavior from decades ago. But nonetheless, they do in many cases represent sort of communities of interest that exist today. And so the Cedar map, which is the one that has sort of a little bit of the central city and a little bit of the sort of Stalwood zone, is the one that really is designed around transit corridors, recognizing that transit corridors are how people experience the city. Now, the mental map you have in your own head of the city doesn't really match what you would look at on an atlas, on a map. You know, the way you drive to your best friend's house may not be the most efficient way, but it's the way you learned, it's the way you think, it's most convenient to you. The place you like to shop is on the way. And so transit corridors in particular, this sort of the Southeast 12th road, which is a very busy road, is a boundary in the Cedar map. I-84 is a partial boundary in the Cedar map. Sandy Boulevard is a partial boundary. 82nd is a partial boundary. So it's really thinking about those transit and transportation corridors as boundaries in the Cedar map.
Interesting. I really respect the amount of premeditation and thought that's been put into the developments of these maps and taking into account neighborhood associations, the existing power structure, but also taking into account underrepresentation. And you know, so I tip my hat to you. In the last minute or so that we have available here to talk, let's talk about citizen involvement. Participation, yeah, in this product, in these maps.
So here's where we are. We've produced these three finalist maps, and it was a consensus decision to release all three to the public. I should rephrase that. I think it was a It was not quite a consensus decision. There was a vote, 8-5 vote to actually release all three. But I would say all three of the maps, each of the three maps has strong support on the commission. And so now we want to hear from the public. We want to hear what makes sense to you. Per the city charter that the voters approved in 2022, there are going to be at least two hearings in each of the four districts. We have three maps, so some of the meetings are happening in place. They're trying to find where the overlaps are, right? But two meetings in the East District, two meetings in the West District, two in the North District, and two in the Inner Southeast District. And there may be some additional hearings. These eight hearings, which are all happening between July 5th and July 16th, are all in-person meetings at public locations. There will not be an online component to them. We were not able to get hybrid or online options for some of them, so they decided not to do it for any of them for equity reasons. There may be, they're working on setting up additional online-only hearings for those folks who want to participate that way. But I would encourage you to go to the City of Portland website, Independent District Commission, and you'll find all eight meetings. Some are during the week, in the evenings, some are during the day, on the weekends. I would encourage you to go to them. You don't need to go to the one that's in the area in which you live. You can go to any of them make your voice known. Let us know what makes sense. I will just say that if you're asking us to move a boundary in one area, recognize that that's going to, you know, every push, there's a pull. You're poking on a balloon. If you poke in one place, it's going to go out somewhere else. And so be prepared for somebody to ask you, but if we move the boundary there, how will we balance it somewhere else? Because that's how this game is played. That's July. And then we will spend August as a commission reviewing all of that feedback. And then we are by law obligated to have one map that gets 9 of the 13 commissioners to vote in favor no later than September 1st. If we fail, the city council will decide from among the maps that we've developed here.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate you giving everybody the time frame. So for more information, you can go to the City of Portland website, Independent District Commission. The agenda or the schedule of upcoming public hearings, comments on the maps, the three maps that have been proposed, that are being proposed, can be made there. Sounds like this is all wrapping up here pretty quick here in September. It's mandated that you do it.
By law, it must be done by September 1st. That's right.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you the best of luck. If folks have questions for Cara, they can go to the City of Portland website and get a hold of the folks on the commission. Cara right. Chisholm, thank you, sir, for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And I have the pleasure today of interviewing Kathy Spofford. And Kathy is a activist in relation to the Zenith Energy Terminal that is a part of the Central Energy Infrastructure Hub that is located along the Willamette River here in Portland. There's been a lot of activism of lately that you may have heard of. Recently, there was kayakistas that were out in front on the Willamette River, the St. John's Bridge, protesting and raising awareness of the Zenith Energy Terminal specifically. Kathy, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Please share with me, what has motivated you to become an environmental activist in this issue?
Well, my motivation comes from concern over the future for my grandchildren. When I retired, I decided to devote most of my energy into environmental work.
And what is it that about the situation with the Zenith Energy Terminal that has motivated you to go to that next level of activism?
Well, Zenith Energy is a transloading facility, so they bring in fossil fuels on train. They store it in tanks, and then they transfer it to barges that go down the Willamette and the Columbia. And none of the crude oil that they're transloading from what we know, is used in Oregon. So they're basically using Oregon as a pass-through, where we accept all the risk and we don't really get much benefit from it.
Now, if I understand correctly, the Zenith Energy Terminal is just one facet or one terminal in a much larger terminal that is along the Willamette River.
That's correct. So, and they're all on a liquefaction zone. If there was a large Cascadia subduction earthquake, all of that land could liquefy and tanks could rupture, the contents could spill into the river, it could cause fires. The Zenith and the rest of the CEI hub are located along Highway 30, so they're along the river. They're also right next to Forest Park, which would be very vulnerable if there were fires in that area.
Because of its proximity and its location within the city limits, you would think that the city of Portland would have some ability to regulate these terminals. I understand that there's been some efforts, but then there's been some setbacks in those attempts to regulate it.
Well, there was an effort to get the city to rescind the land use compatibility statement that Zenith was asking for. And originally, they denied it. Zenith appealed. It was at the state Supreme Court when Zenith made a deal with the city to say that in 5 years they would switch to biofuels. And so the city granted them another LUX. And the first LUX, I guess, expired.
The LUX being the permit, the land use permit.
The land use compatibility statement, which allows them to now get an air quality permit. They've been operating for years without their own air quality permit. They have had a expired air quality permit that used to belong to an asphalt company. That whole area where Zenith is was an asphalt company originally. And then it went to another Arc Logistics, and then Zenith bought it in 2018. They have a history of buying up properties like asphalt companies and flipping them and turning them into fossil fuel terminals.
You know, one thing when I was doing some homework about the topic before our interview, I realized that Zenith is a multinational corporation. It's a very large corporation. So this is not a unique situation here in Portland as far as them owning facilities that can have a strong environmental impact.
That's true. They're in Europe, and they're in all parts of the United States.
Now, bringing it back here to the local level, you mentioned that a land use compatibility permit had been issued, but then it was rescinded, did you say? Or was it, am I flipping that around? It was, they denied it, but then they approved it.
It was appealed, and what they were asking for was more findings from the city, and it had gone up to the Supreme Court that said the city did have jurisdiction to deny it. But at that point, there was some negotiations and deal between Zenith Energy and the city, and they decided to issue them another LUX, saying that because they agreed to phase out fossil fuels in the next 5 years and bring in biofuels, that was more compatible with our city's comprehensive plan.
Interesting. You know, one thing that really strikes me about the location of this facility is its proximity to the river and to all this glorious natural habitat that we call home. This facility, how long has it been there for? I'm so surprised that it had not been considered. I mean, I understand that it's along a river and it's along the railroad tracks, and so it was probably from a central location, it was probably ideal, but how was the environmental side of this not taken into account?
I'm not sure how it was taken into account. It's been there for many years. It has been zoned an industrial sanctuary. And originally, some of the facilities, I think, were within the city limit before the area of Linton was part of Portland. And there had been some catastrophic accident, so they had moved it to along the river in an area that was unincorporated at the time.
What actions are your organization, your activist organization, trying to do to, what's the next steps here?
Well, we have a number of steps. We formed a new coalition. It doesn't actually have a name yet. We call it the Emerging Coalition because it's just beginning. And we have a lot of environmental groups who are concerned not only about Zenith, but the CEI Club, the health of the river, the health of the communities around the river. And so we're trying to target city government, our county commissioners, who have been very responsive, state government, Governor Kotek, and our federal representative, because there's a lot of different jurisdictions that have control over that area. Federally, the trains that carry the crude oil into Portland are managed by the federal government, not something the city could get involved in. So there's a lot of layers, and so we're trying to target all of those various levels of government and encourage them to collaborate together to have a plan to make this a safe area, to possibly remove some of the tanks. Right now, there is a study group that is developing rules for the tank owners to monitor their tanks and ensure that they're safe, seismically safe. Some of the tanks were built before 1929. You know, many of them are in pretty poor condition. There's a flyover video that Jay Wilson, who's the resilience coordinator at Clackamas County, put out. And it's really frightening to look at because there's a lot of corrosion on the tops of the tanks, and you really see how large the area is and how prone it could be to a horrible disaster.
You know, it's funny. I saw that video. Well, it's not funny, but I did see that video that you shared with me prior to this interview, and I was struck as to the proximity of all of this energy infrastructure right next to our rivers, right next to Forest Park. And then for those that have not seen this video, imagine, of course, a drone starting on one end of this infrastructure facility and going all the way down to the end of this facility, long stretch, a very long stretch of miles. And imagine looking at these containers, these oil tanks, very, very, very large oil tanks. And you were, Kathy, you were mentioning that the corrosion on top. I remember seeing that, the corrosion on the tops of these containers. It was troublesome.
And it's not, the river and Forest Park, but there's also communities there. Linton is a community of people, and the Linton Neighborhood Association has been working on this issue for many years. They have a new group called Tanks to Tanks, and they just put up three large billboards on Highway 30 to alert people to the dangers. There's daycare centers. There's also people who live along the tracks. The train most likely come up from through Washington and then cross over the cut through St. John's and down to Zenith Energy. But those trains carry Bakken crude oil. In the past, they have carried tar sands crude, which is very dangerous. And even if they do switch to some biodiesels, renewable diesel, they're still flammable. They can still spill. And they really delay our move to electrification and sustainable energy.
Why was Zenith Energy's energy terminal targeted for your activism?
given that there is it's a part of a larger hub?
Well, it's probably the newest facility. I mean, they bought it in 2018. It had been an asphalt company, and it's changed considerably over the number of years. They built a lot of racks to unload their crude oil. I had some figures here. In 2019, they transloaded 167 million gallons of oil. But in 2022, it was up to 374 million. So this is a company that is increasing its throughput. And in the past, they have not always been very forthcoming with the city. I know that they got into trouble because they did some building without getting a stormwater permit. They seem to, cut corners and do what they want to do.
Has Zenith has not been receptive or has not been responsive to the general public's and to efforts to try to help to revise this?
I don't believe we've had really any conversations with them.
That must be challenging when you have an opponent that won't even acknowledge you.
Well, we have an opponent that has a lot of money. They're a large corporation and they have expensive legal counsel. But we're a pretty dedicated group of activists.
One thing I have really a lot of respect for is how your activism has been able to break through the media silence on these types of issues. And you've done that through very public displays, but very unique public displays. Tell me a little bit about the most recent one.
Well, right now we're having forums, which are called Wormo on the River. I think we're on number 8. Where various expert engineers, environmental activists, medical people talk about the situation at Zenith and the CEI Hub. In the past, when we could approach the tracks, we have had vigils. We had 5 people arrested there, I think it was 2019, for building a garden on the tracks and trying to reclaim the land. They were charged, but I believe there was a hung jury and they were acquitted using the necessity defense, saying that because of the extreme danger of the CEI Hub and Zenith, that using any means necessary was okay.
What are the next action steps that your groups are going to be taking to try to raise awareness or to try to prevent this?
Well, that's what we're working with the coalition on. We're going to be sending postcards to a lot of our elected officials. We're having meetings with neighborhood associations. We've had 14 meetings with neighborhood associations, and many of them are going to be signing onto a joint letter asking the city, the state, federal officials to come up with a plan to get possibly move or at least make the CEI Hub a safer place, and also to terminate Zenith's presence there.
If one of my listeners is motivated after hearing this interview to want to join your efforts, what can they do? How can they get a hold of your groups?
Well, I think the best thing to do would be to go to the next forum, which is going to be at Central Lutheran Wednesday the 28th at 6:30. And they can sign up there. You can post my email address. If they belong to a neighborhood association or a group of people who are interested, we would come and give them a presentation.
Mm-hmm. I read in preparation for the interview, I read this article about your recent event there at St. John's Bridge with the kayakers.
Yes.
how did that go? That is one of those more visible events. I really respect the fact that not only was it focused on a very important issue, but it was also availing itself of the very environment that we're trying to preserve here, you know, by being in the river like that.
It was a great event. It was organized by 350, and yes, there were many kayakers out in the water. I'm a kayaker. I wasn't in the water that day, but you know, that's one of the reasons I'm so concerned about this. I love the river. I love to kayak on the Willamette and down into the Columbia, and I just can't imagine anything happening to that river.
You know, just once again, just to paint worst case scenario here, which is a very viable one, share with folks what the biggest fear is for your groups, and then let's leave on an optimistic note here.
Okay,
what can be done to make sure that we can prevent this?
Well, the city and the county actually did a joint report, CEI Hub seismic risk analysis. And they said that if there was an earthquake, a large earthquake in that area, it could be equivalent to the size of the oil spill at the BP Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, that would be horrendous. 90% of the fuel that we use in Oregon is stored there, like diesel, oil, aviation fuel. It would be a catastrophe economically because none of those fuels would be available. It would be a catastrophe because it would pollute the river, killing wildlife and fish. It would impact people who live in the area. There could be toxic chemicals in the air, and Forest Park would be in danger of fire. So that is what people are really concerned about. It's protecting people, the environment, and our economy.
Very good. And then now, let's leave on a positive note here.
Okay.
And that is, what would you like to see happen here? What would be the best case scenario for you?
Well, the best case scenario would be that now the Department of Environmental Quality, EQ, would not grant Zenith Energy an air quality permit. We don't feel that, you know, they belong in that area, and they do vent some of their tanks, and certainly there could be leakage when fuels are transported from one tank to the ships or along the rail. As far as the whole CEI hub, many people would like to see some of it relocated. At the very least, we want to see that the tanks are upgraded, that there may not be as many tanks in the area as there are now. Senator Dudembrow had passed a bill, and there's a rules committee designing the rules that will govern how that happens.
I've been speaking with Kathy Spofford. Kathy is an activist to working to prevent the Zenith Energy Terminal from being located where it's at here along the Willamette River here in Portland, and an environmental activist. I'd like to thank you very much for your time today, and we will have your contact information posted on our KBOO website under our with the audio. So when folks are ready, they can go there and they can get some information about your
That's great. Your Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. You just heard Moses Ross on two interviews. The first one was Kari Chisholm and the new governance organization in Portland. Very insightful interview. Chisholm is exceptionally knowledgeable in this area. And then the second interview was with Kathy Spofford regarding the land use permit for Zenith Corporation. And the article, I wanted to let you know that the article that Moses was referencing is in the Portland Mercury, and it was posted on in the environmental section on June 9th. And it is about, give me one moment, accidentally clicked on a button. Climate activists to protest Zenith Oil along the Willamette River. And it was a kayak demonstration along the Willamette River that was referenced in that interview. Coming up at 8, from 8 to 10, is Ditch Digger. And Ditch Digger is an eclectic slum of garage, R&B, doo-wop, soul, and punk. It's an awesome show. Also, I wanted to let you know that KBOO has tons of opportunities for volunteering. So contact our volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org, and you can be involved in things like on-air public affairs hosting, like what we do. You can have a music show, you can do podcasting, you can do some data entry, some reception, some social media. There's a plethora of activities that you can be involved in here at KBOO. We want to thank you for your support. Oh, and while you're at the KBOO website, hit that donate button or consider doing so, so we can keep serving you with awesome content 24/7. Here's a little Lenny Kravitz before Ditch Digger comes in.